As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Welcome to this week's Athletic Football Tactics podcast, and thank you for choosing to listen to us today. I'm Ali Maxwell, and each week I pick the tactical and analytical brains of Michael Cox and Mark Kerry of The Athletic. Hi, Mark. How are you?
Good. Thank you, Ali. Always good to see you. How are you?
Really well, thanks. In your role as a Liverpool fan, you must be in quite some state at the moment. Passage through to the Champions League final. As we record, that was last night. We don't know who Liverpool will be playing just yet. But as I saw someone called AK say on Twitter this morning, this month, the Reds could become the greatest English team of all time or 2022 Carabao Cup winners.
That is true. I was thinking as well, I don't know which other teams will have played every possible game that they've entered in for. Historically, I need to look into that to see when that might have been previously. It was never in doubt, was it? 2-0 down at halftime, one of the worst performances from a Liverpool side for a number of years. I don't think they could have possibly played any worse in the second half, so they could only improve. Really good substitution, obviously, to bring Luis Diaz on. And I think, yeah, they could only improve and eventually got the 3-2 win. So never in doubt, never in doubt.
Hello, Michael Cox. How's things?
Hi, good, Ali. Yeah, just written an analysis of that game.
362 days ago, you tweeted, Emery knows how to win the Europa League better than anyone, but if he plays Rulli in goal in the biggest game in VRL's history, bloody hell.
Yeah, Rulli's a funny goalkeeper. He was the backup last year, but got played in the Europa League, which seems strange to me. It seems even stranger that he's now the first choice. But I don't think he covered himself with glory on any of those three goals last night.
Last weekend, you went to watch Pep Guardiola's set-piece monsters.
Yeah, I mean, that was a bit of a surprise. They scored two goals against Leeds from set pieces and two from open play, but really it was set pieces that won it. And I noticed that they'd now scored 18 set piece goals this season and only conceded one, and emailed someone at Opta saying, how close is this to the best record that you've got in the Premier League era or since Opta started recording set pieces, which I think is 2006. And I was delighted to learn that it makes them, well, they have the best set piece goal difference on record so far. Obviously could go down before the end of the campaign. But yeah, that was a good basis for my article.
You'll never sing that. Well, they also came up against the Leeds United side, whose fans, I think, are getting quite tired of seeing them conceding goals from set pieces. The Opta analyst site has them top of the table for set piece goals conceded this season, also with 18. So that was perhaps predictable. Now, today we're going to talk about a manager involved in the Champions League semi-finals, and that is Carlo Ancelotti, Real Madrid manager. We're not talking about him because of the Champions League, although he is one of only three managers to have won the Champions League three times. Michael, to introduce the topic, I'm going to ask you a very simple quiz question that everyone will know. What can Tomislav Ivic and Carlo Ancelotti say that no other human in the history of the planet can say?
Well, they've won a league title as a manager in five different countries, I believe. I was scared you were going to ask me which countries Ivic has won. I mean, I would have been really struggling on that. But yeah, they've both won the title in five countries. And Ancelotti, of course, has done it in what we consider the five major leagues, Italy, England, France, Germany, Spain, in that order. And that is really impressive. I mean, that is, I mean, completely unmatched in terms of, you know, serious football leagues, if we're being honest. I don't think anyone else has won more than three of those five. So to win five, yeah, that's an incredible achievement.
And we were not going to let that go without marking it with a tactics pod on Carlo Ancelotti. We're going to leaf through the book of Carletto, interrailing across European football and tracking those league titles one by one, dissecting his tactics, his management style and his success. Quick note before we get into it, we haven't seen the second semi-final yet between Manchester City and Real Madrid. By the time you listen to this, Real Madrid may have pulled off a magnificent aggregate comeback and might find themselves playing Liverpool in the final in Paris, or it might be a glorious failure. We do not know, so that will not be referenced forthwith. Let's start, Michael, at AC Milan, where he won his first league title in 2003-2004. It was his seventh season in management. He had started with Reggiana, moved on to Parma and then Juventus. The Juve fans, not a huge fan of Ancelotti, I think it's fair to say. They once unveiled a banner saying, "A pig can't coach," which referred to his agricultural background. Also a bit of a quirk here. He was a Champions League winner before a league winner, and it was the Champions League really that defined his time at AC Milan.
Yeah, it was, for better or worse, because they got to three finals and people probably remember the one that they lost far more than the ones that they won, of course, with that incredible collapse against Liverpool. And yet, a slight confusing thing for me has always been that Milan were probably the best side in Europe over a course of 5 or 6 years, that 5 or 6 year period. They were very, very consistent and generally went very far in the Champions League, but they only won one league title. And I think that could be considered a bit of an underachievement. When they did win it, they won it in style in 2003-2004. I thought went slightly under the radar in terms of how good it was. There was a lot of stuff happening that year. Porto won the European Cup. Arsenal won the Premier League undefeated. But Milan only lost twice all season. And one of those came after they'd already secured the title. So this was a really, really good team. So yeah, it was the Champions League that defined him rather than his league title success.
What about the players that he had at his disposal? I think there's a lot of people listening who'll be able to roll 11 Milan players' names off their tongue from this period. But how did he fit them all together, get the best out of them?
Well, that was the interesting thing, because he had a big disagreement with Berlusconi, who obviously was not just the owner of Milan, but obviously someone who had who wanted to have a big say in how his team should play. And what Ancelotti wanted to do was he wanted to play two playmakers behind one striker. He liked playing Shevchenko up front and he liked having Kaká and Rui Costa behind. And Berlusconi always wanted two strikers. So he wanted Inzaghi and Shevchenko, basically, with Rui Costa being the odd man out and having to drop out. A few complications there. One, because Inzaghi had a lot of injuries. So sometimes it's actually John Dal Thomason who flopped a bit in Newcastle, but had a really good time at Milan, who played instead of Inzaghi. But yeah, there was always this kind of standoff between what Ancelotti wanted and what the president wanted. So in the end, it was more regularly a diamond with Kaká as the number 10 behind two strikers, and then a very ambitious midfield trio, I would say, or a diamond. But the three behind were Gattuso, Pirlo and Seedorf. Obviously, Gattuso primarily a runner, a tackler, a battler. But there weren't really many players around like Pirlo at that time in European football. And to play him as the deepest midfielder with Seedorf to the left and then Kaká and then sometimes Rui Costa as well. That was, I mean, playing almost four playmakers at a time when most sides in Europe were only playing one. So that was quite special in a way.
And clearly football looked quite different then and the tactical trends were very different to what we recognise now. But give us an idea of you know, how that team thrived. The fact of it being a diamond, obviously you have Cafu at right back and, you know, he mixed and matched a little bit down the left side. Did they play with width or, you know, that I've got this image in my head of there being so many incredible technical and skillful midfield players that they just play through the middle the whole time. But realistically, that probably wasn't the case.
I mean, they did. I think of them as really maintaining long spells of possession in the centre with those midfielders. Yeah, the width came from the fact that they had Cafu at right back, who was getting on a bit at this stage, but, you know, played very well into his late 30s. The left was a bit of a funny one. It was often Pancoro who played left back, who was quite a kind of old school Italian fullback, did a job, wasn't particularly great on the overlap. But they did have Serginho, who they could bring on usually as a substitute, who offered something similar to Cafu down the left. I really like Serginho. I think he's a really good player. So yeah, it was relatively narrow, I would say. And I think that was a feature of early Ancelotti teams, because when he went to Chelsea, he tried playing a diamond as well.
Okay, so he wins one Serie A title, and we've got this sort of battle between the diamond, the Christmas tree formation. Is that seen as a good return or a poor return? One Serie A title in that time.
Well, it was a funny time, of course, because you have Calciopoli as well, which Milan were a little bit caught up on a few years later. So that was 2006, 2007 when the points deductions came in. I think there's generally a feeling they should have done slightly better. You know, like I say, they had a run to three Champions League finals. They had Kaká, who by 2007 won the Ballon d'Or, was the best player in the world. I think they probably should have won at least one extra. I don't think those Inter sides were particularly formidable as well. I think there was a couple of seasons where Milan probably should have triumphed ahead of them. So yeah, that's the funny thing about Ancelotti. He's won one league title in five different countries, but there's various times where you could say maybe he should have won more.
Mm. Well, his next club was Chelsea in the Premier League, and he won the title in 2009-2010 at the first time of asking, a double in fact with the FA Cup as well. He had taken over after a season that started with Scolari and ended with Hiddink. I imagine, Michael, Chelsea at that time really going after the Champions League, there must have been quite a lot of excitement at having hired someone with such pedigree in that competition. How did it look in the Premier League? How did it go for Ancelotti at Chelsea?
Well, it was a funny season. They started very, very well. I think first 10 games, they won 9 maybe off the top of my head. I think the interesting thing is that he started with a diamond, and it was almost like he wanted to play the system he'd used at Milan. And then they almost got a little bit found out midway through the, or in the autumn. I think they won, had a run of 3 games where they didn't win. And it was almost like teams had worked out that if you just force them wide, they don't have that much, because Ivanovic was the right back at the time. Wasn't a natural right back at that point. Was a centre back who'd been converted to right back. They played the start of the season with Bosingwa, who then got injured and couldn't contribute. So had Ashley Cole down the left, of course, who was very good going forward. But if you just force the play out to Ivanovic, I didn't think Chelsea offered that much. And so they had this big rejig after about a third of the season where Ancelotti went to 4-3-3 instead, played Anelka on the right. Well, he was a little bit out of place, but he had the pace and the trickery to do it. Malouda on the left, and of course, Drogba up front. And I think that suited a lot of the players more. It suited Lampard more, who I think struggled in a diamond because he wanted to be on the left of a three, but highest up. I don't think he really worked either at the top of the diamond or on the left. And that really got Chelsea over the line. I thought they were a little bit fortunate that season, to be honest, because I think in the two games against Manchester United, they were fortunate to get 6 points from those games. And when you look at the table, that proved crucial. But they were very, very good at breaking down the weaker sides, particularly towards the end of the campaign, where they were almost semi-regularly scoring 6 and 7 and 8. It was quite spectacular.
I think as well, aside from the tactical side of things, their core squad was largely made up of players who were sort of 28 plus, all kind of strong men, you sort of might say. You think of obviously Petr Cech, Frank Lampard, John Terry, Drogba was, I think, 31 at that stage. Anelka just turned 30. Michael Ballack, 32. Florin Malouda, I thought, was younger at that time. I think he was 29 at that point. So they were all kind of primed, if not maybe slightly over their prime, in terms of their age, kind of ready to have a real threat for the title. And you think about who their competitors were that season. Liverpool had pushed for the title the season before, and they lost Xabi Alonso to Real Madrid. United had pushed them all the way, which we can come on to that season, but they just sort of still adapting to a post-Cristiano Ronaldo era after. Obviously, he went to Real Madrid as well. So they had a really kind of strong core experienced squad. Ancelotti had Ray Wilkins as well. I think Ray Wilkins helped with a lot of the managers coming from abroad to bridge that gap in terms of whether it be language or just simply getting a sort of a feel for the club. And it also helped that two of their main men that season were having their best goal scoring season of their careers. So Didier Drogba scored 29 goals in the Premier League that season, which was his highest in a league season across his whole career. And Frank Lampard scored 22 goals that season, which is also the highest of his career. Next highest for him in his career was 16. So it shows just how prolific he was. And maybe when you think about the whole Lampard making late runs into the box and being a goal scoring midfielder, that season might have typified that more than any.
Yeah, that was the funny thing about Drogba. He went off to the AFCON and came back. And I thought there was a bit of an awkward compromise about how Chelsea were going to play. Because when Drogba was away and Anelka was up front and was linking the play with Malouda running forward, I think Joe Cole running forward, they were a lot more fluid, actually, with someone who was a real good link player like Anelka. And when Drogba came back, I thought their build-up play and their combination play in the final third was a little bit stilted. And the crucial thing, or the crucial game of the season, was away at Old Trafford, where Manchester United won 2-1. And Ancelotti actually left out Drogba from the starting 11, which, you know, was a big surprise. As Mark said, he went on to win the Golden Boot that season. He came on as a sub. He replaced Anelka and he did score. But again, they played very well in that game for the first hour without Drogba. I think it was amongst the best football they played in that run-in. And Ancelotti, a few years later, said that it was because Drogba had been late for a team meeting and therefore he was punishing him by leaving him out of the side. But I wonder whether it had been, if it had been Petr Cech who was late for a team meeting, would he have made the same decision? I couldn't help thinking that that was quite a convenient excuse almost to play without a player who, you know, a little bit like what we're seeing now, you know, strikers are not in fashion at the moment because, they don't have the build-up play that makes the team better. So I almost think that was a prototype of what we're seeing with, I don't know, maybe Lukaku at the moment, where Chelsea just look better with someone who can link play rather than someone who's a proper number nine.
Of course, they start the next season defending their title with 2-6-0 wins against West Brom and Wigan. They only score from that point 57 goals in the next 36 games in the Premier League. So they really struggled to recapture that goal-scoring form, Michael. Was this a case, or maybe our first sense of why perhaps Ancelotti was so good at winning, or is so good at winning titles, but not so good at defending them?
Yeah, I think that is possibly true. It was a strange second season that. I mean, they brought in Torres midway through, which I don't think Ancelotti really wanted, and he struggled to fit him into the side. I mean, it's interesting what Mark says about the age of the players, because that was the same at Milan. I mean, that was a very old side, and there was never really any almost evolution of the side, really. And it was kind of the same at Chelsea. I feel like Ancelotti's very good at working with players who are already at the kind of required level and just helping them over the line and letting them kind of almost do what comes naturally to them. So I think of Chelsea and Milan as relatively similar in terms of age profile and at the start in terms of the system that Ancelotti wanted to play in terms of the diamond. And I would say, again, one out of two league titles. I think there was basically two teams going for the league those 2 years, Chelsea and Manchester United. Not really many others were in the picture. So it was probably about par, I think, without wanting to be too harsh.
This is the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. In part two, we continue to watch Ancelotti win a lot of titles in France and Germany and in Spain. That's next.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Michael, he pitches up in Paris and wins Ligue 1 in 2012-13. Now, Paris Saint-Germain might have won 8 of 10 from that point, but this was their first league title for 20 years.
It was. Well, it was a funny one because he actually took over midway through the previous campaign when I think I'm right saying PSG were top of the league, replaced a guy called Antoine Comboiré, who was doing a pretty decent job with a very newly assembled squad, really. Lots of players coming in at once. I thought was doing quite well. And it was them against Montpellier, Olivier Giroud's Montpellier.
Oh, yes.
Going for the title. And really, Ancelotti's introduction, I mean, it's not like he ruined the side, but they certainly didn't improve. I mean, they ended up losing the title to Montpellier, who, you know, a pretty plucky club with a couple of good players. But for a side with all these stars in, that was a bit of a a bit of a poor result, if we're being honest. But the next season, I mean, they won it relatively comfortably. And again, you start to see some familiar things from what we've already talked about. You see some relatively old players who know what to do with themselves. Most obviously, Ibrahimovic, who plays up front and bangs in the goals. And also quite a narrow side. I mean, he started with a 4-3-2-1, pretty much the Christmas tree that he favoured at Milan. Various players playing behind Ibrahimovic. You had Lovetsi, you had Jeremy Menez, you had Nene, who had a really good couple of seasons for PSG. And again, I wouldn't say it was an overwhelmingly cohesive side, but they were the best side in Ligue 1 by a country mile. Ibrahimovic scored a lot of goals. And yeah, it was the kind of Ancelotti template was now very much established.
Yeah, you see the trend as well throughout all of these of having that focal point, that really prolific striker, which I'm sure we'll come on to some of the others as well of that. But you're right as well with Ibrahimovic, just to kind of pad out what Michael's saying in terms of the numbers, 30 goals he scored that season, which was comfortably the highest of anyone in the French league. And second on the list actually was a young Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang at Saint-Étienne, which is interesting. But yeah, 30 goals for Ibrahimovic. He was completely the focal point for that side, wasn't he? He had the second highest minutes played, so it shows just how important he was, of course. And again, it's a trend which I'll come onto as well for Bayern Munich. But the next highest goal scorer in the squad that year was Kevin Gamero with 8 goals. And he only started 7 league games that season. And then below him was Blaise Matuidi with 5 goals. So if you think that your midfielder is your third highest scorer in the squad and not really a prolific one at that, then it shows just how much that Ibrahimovic was the focal point of the side, which of course makes sense.
Ancelotti had a good relationship with Marco Verratti, Michael, at PSG. And I think with Ancelotti's Milan side, it is the central midfielders that you think about most strongly and with most nostalgia. In terms of modern-day midfielders, Verratti and Ancelotti, that feels like a lovely blend, a place for Verratti in any Ancelotti side.
The funny thing about Verratti was I remember the first time I saw him playing for PSG in the Champions League, and I'm fairly sure he came on as a sub for David Beckham, which feels like a really weird kind of... they feel like completely different eras to me, Verratti and David Beckham. But yeah, I mean, again, if there's any manager who's going to embrace a midfielder like that, it was Ancelotti. He worked with Pirlo at Milan. I think he wanted to bring Pirlo to Chelsea, actually. And so, yeah, Verratti kind of slots in and is immediately a very, very talented player. But he'd moved from Serie B, I think I'm right in saying. So it was, you know, throwing him into a title challenger at such a young age was a fairly bold call and maybe goes against what we've said in terms of Ancelotti working with older players. But yeah, stylistically, he was perfect for that kind of team.
Yeah, he'd come from Pescara in Serie B, who, if my memory serves me correct, were really one of the sort of hipster's choice teams of that, what I would consider the early Twitter era, with Verratti, with Immobile, with Insigne, and with Zeman in the dugout as well. That's a kind of iconic side from that period. He goes to Bayern Munich, 2016-17, wins the Bundesliga. Michael, what was the situation at Bayern upon his arrival? What did he step into?
Well, he stepped into a side that had just been coached very well by Pep Guardiola for 3 years. And I think the consensus is that some of the players found themselves a little bit underwhelmed by Ancelotti's lack of attention to detail, by how relaxed his training sessions were. There were various reports that the players were kind of staying behind and conducting their own training sessions to almost fill in the blanks, which is not a particularly, doesn't speak very highly of what Ancelotti was doing with them. I mean, to be honest, I just think of this as a pretty forgettable era for Bayern. The Guardiola era was very memorable. Flick era was very memorable. Maybe Nagelsmann in a couple of years, we'll be talking about them. Yeah, him as a very special manager, but this felt to me like probably the least interesting Bayern Munich season in the last decade or so. They were obviously a good side. They won the league. They had lots of star players. Lewandowski, Sean, a couple of the other attacking players were very good, but it certainly wasn't a vintage side. And the fact that he didn't last long, I think, probably speaks more, you know, it's a bit more of an indicator of how he performed rather than the fact that they won the league, which, if we're being honest, it was 1 in 10 years in the middle of that 10-year sequence. It's not particularly spectacular to win the league with Bayern Munich.
Yeah, I was going to say, Bayern at that point, well, still to this day, they haven't not won the Bundesliga since 2011-12 season. So yeah, while it was a good title win, it wasn't like they were sort of dragging them from It wasn't like Ancelotti was dragging them from the depths of despair. So there is that to it. But they largely set up with a sort of more of a 4-2-3-1, but would occasionally play a 4-3-3 or rotate between the two. And it's probably one of the same thing, really. They'd have that midfield trio of Thiago maybe slightly ahead, more as a playmaker, a bit more of a number 10 with Vidal, almost as the Gattuso, would you say, Michael, and Alonso more as the Pirlo, if we're going to compare it to the AC Milan sort of time. Philipp Lahm would step in sometimes in the midfield to make way for a young Joshua Kimmich as well at right back as well. But they played a very high line, didn't they, as well, and still sort of had the sweeper keeper in Manuel Neuer as well. So, it was interesting as well to read the piece on Ancelotti on the Athletic website of Kit Holden saying how there were the times when Ancelotti maybe wasn't getting the best out of Thomas Müller as well. I think we think of him as a really strong number 10, sort of centrally playing off maybe sometimes as a second striker, but he would sometimes be pushed wide and not quite get the best out of him as well. So maybe that kind of fed into the discontent in the squad as well. But then they went and won the league, so no problem in the end.
It is funny, isn't it, Michael? This ends up being basically a net negative for Ancelotti despite winning the Bundesliga, because it's probably the first time that this guy, who is considered one of the great man managers, particularly of star players, is described as having lost a dressing room. That there becomes a suggestion that actually maybe the next crop of top level players needs something more from a manager than his calm leadership, which is the name of his autobiography. This is it marks a bit of a sort of change in how people started to perceive Ancelotti, I think.
Yeah, I agree. That was a big surprise. That was the one thing he was renowned for. He'd get the big players on side and there wouldn't be any problems in the dressing room. But yeah, it does seem like it was a bit of an anticlimax almost after being coached by Guardiola for 3 years and the players seemed quite underwhelmed. So yeah, that was a bit of a come down. And that was the point where I thought maybe his time as a really top manager is starting to be the end of that era. And of course, he went on to Napoli and then Everton. I mean, two massive clubs, particularly Napoli, but not sides really who were on that level, not Real Madrid, Milan, PSG, Bayern, Chelsea levels. And the problem, I think, at Napoli, I mean, we won't go into depth with this because he didn't win the league, but it was a kind of similar thing. He was taking over from Sarri, who was so much about attention to detail and really set passing patterns. I think the players just found themselves quite underwhelmed. So this is the period where I thought, four leagues you've won, but there's no chance you're going to make it a fifth, Carlo.
Well, between the PSG Ligue 1 title and the Bayern Bundesliga title, he had managed Real Madrid, where he, in kind of classic Carlo fashion, had notched up another Champions League title, but hadn't won La Liga in two attempts. Then Napoli and Everton, which we're going to touch on in part three. Back to Real Madrid 2021-22 and wins La Liga. Having not won it in his first stint, he now has all five. Michael, just to expand on what you were saying there, I guess it's hard to imagine any of the other, let's say, top 5 to 10 clubs in Europe hiring Ancelotti off of Everton at that point in time. Indeed, a quote from Dermot Corrigan's piece about their title win says, Ancelotti was a patch to cover after Zidane. And you wrote, this time last year, it seemed as if Carlo Ancelotti's time as an elite football manager was over. But here he is completing the set.
Yeah, remarkable, really. I mean, again, a funny kind of situation where so many leagues these days aren't actually that competitive. You know, in the 80s and 90s, if you won the league as a manager, you'd done a brilliant job. Whereas it feels like Ancelotti has gone to PSG, he's gone to Bayern, and he's gone to Real Madrid, and he hasn't performed brilliantly. He's just kept the group together. He's kept things ticking over. I think Real Madrid suits him because, you know, much like his Milan side, for example, there's very creative midfielders there who can kind of control games by themselves. It's a relatively old side. There's not that many young players that Ancelotti needs to kind of really develop. And of course, there's not that much competition in La Liga at the moment. Barcelona have been in a mini crisis. Atleti didn't challenge at all in the league this year. So, I mean, the fact that they won the league four games from the end, despite the fact that we're not really speaking about them as a great side, I think shows the fact that this was built for Ancelotti. Again, it might sound harsh to call him a bit of a patch, but he is the man you want in this kind of situation.
And how does this Real Madrid team play under Ancelotti? Formation, style, key men?
Well, I think there's a combination of two classic Ancelotti things. One is a kind of experienced midfield who can control the game. And the other is a couple of key individuals who, to a certain extent, are given freedom to do what they want. And Benzema and Vinicius have been probably the best two players in La Liga this year, I would say. They just individually, they're great. They combine very well. And we do have to give Ancelotti credit for, I think, for, you know, Vinicius has had a really, really good season, probably beyond what we've seen from him before. Defensively, I think they're broadly good. I think against good opposition, they've sometimes been exposed. They lost 4-0 to Barcelona, which is quite a remarkable situation to lose 4-0 to a side who weren't really challenging you in the league. And I think at times we've seen them a little bit exposed in the Champions League that Benzema's brilliance has just covered for. So yeah, they're a decent side. But again, I wouldn't put this down as a vintage Real Madrid team.
I think it's really interesting what you say about the defence as well, Michael. I looked into the numbers on this. So typically the team with the best attack and the best defence wins the league. Often their statistics will suggest that they are strongest at both ends. And as you mentioned, Madrid's attack and their creative players are the best around, and Benzema and Vinicius Jr. really have been the best in La Liga. But as you say, their defence wasn't the best, and it's shown more so in their underlying numbers than their actual goals conceded. So they were expected to concede 39 goals based on the quality of chances that they gave up, and they actually conceded 28. Now, that difference between expectation and reality is the biggest of any side in La Liga. So, of course, if you win the title, it's not based on luck. Of course, it's a long old season. But just that difference between the two seems to be something which is just worthy of note, especially from that defensive perspective.
Exceptional performances in front of goal from Benz and in goal from Courtois, I think, has certainly helped here. And Michael, sometimes when you track a managerial career over 20 years, there's a lot of times where you can point to moments of evolution, of experiments that come off and then become the norm for a manager. In your piece about this title and Ancelotti's career, there's a line where it suggests that this season at Real, when he has experimented, things have gone awry. And when he's kept it simple, Real have shone. It's, you know, it is actually, this stuff is quite critical almost of Ancelotti, certainly just in the tactical sense. But you can't argue that it's not been pretty consistent throughout his career.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is spot on. I mean, the interesting thing with Ancelotti is that the evolution or the change in his management really happened before any of these titles. The change happened at Juventus. He started out as the assistant manager to Rigo Sacchi, who, of course, is all about the system, doesn't like individuals, doesn't like Roberto Baggio because he's got flair and wants to play as a number 10. He doesn't want that. He plays 4-4-2, you know, gets rid of Zola, and suddenly he goes to Juventus, works with Zidane, and thinks, hang on, Zidane's so good, we've got to build the side around him. And the rest of his career is basically just building his sides around star individuals. And I think his fondness for a diamond or sometimes Christmas tree comes from the fact that often you've got various number 10s or various playmakers you've got to fit into the same team. And he's remained fairly consistent from that stance ever since. But yeah, you're right. He's tried to change formation a couple of times this season. He played diamond early on away at, was it Levante? They lost that. He tried a couple of things against Barcelona with a kind of box midfield, and then he tried a three-man defence in the second half and they lost 4-0. Every time he's tried to go away and try something a little bit clever, it has backfired. And I think that's interesting because Zidane, you know, ironically, the circle was completed with Zidane being Ancelotti's apprentice and managing in a very similar way to him. In the first few seasons of Zidane, you would say he was very Ancelotti. He kept things simple. He didn't try and do clever tactical things. Last season, I actually think Zidane did. I think he was actually suddenly became quite clever tactically. But Ancelotti remains the same old Ancelotti we've known for the last, 20 years now.
Okay, this is the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. And in the final part, Michael's going to build a Carlo Ancelotti composite 11 from all these great teams that he's managed. And we're also going to look a little further at some of the criticisms of his management style and tactics. No doubt while he fires up another cigar and raises his eyebrow. That's next.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS. You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. Shopify.com/theathletic.
So we kind of mix everything that we've said about Carlo Ancelotti together. And unlike most managers, it's quite a large sample size spanning two decades. And one of the things that gets spat out and levelled at him, Michael, is that he only suits the top clubs. Now, for a lot of managers who have that levelled at them, there's really no evidence for or against because they don't manage not the lesser clubs when they reach the very top. You know, people always say, what would Pep Guardiola do with a League Two team? Irrelevant. With Ancelotti, those spells at Everton and Napoli, perhaps we could look a little bit deeper into those and try and appraise those spells to work out whether that criticism of him only suiting the very top clubs with the top players is fair.
Yeah, particularly Everton. I mean, Napoli probably should have been challenging for the title more than they did under him. Everton, yeah, they were a mid-table side, pretty bad side when he took over, actually, from Marco Silva. He had periods where he seemed to like individuals, and he had periods where he basically went back to playing 4-4-2 and went back to what he did the previous time he was in charge of a mid-table club or a lesser club, and just played Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison up front and kept it solid behind. So, yeah, I mean, that Everton spell is very weird in hindsight. It just feels, with all due respect to Everton, big club, but I mean, one that are currently battling to stay up. Just feels so strange to see them amongst, you know, some of the biggest names in European football, where Ancelotti sometimes was taking charge of a side where he was almost expected to win the league title.
I think it's interesting as well about Dominic Calvert-Lewin is that, again, maybe a bit like the club, there's going to be a drop off in the player quality. I mean, he's had Benzema, Lewandowski, he's had Shevchenko, he's had Ibrahimovic, he's had all these players who are world-class strikers who are going to get upwards of maybe 30 goals a season or thereabouts. Didier Drogba, you'd add to that as well. And Dominic Calvert-Lewin is a very good player, and he scored a lot of goals. He's quite prolific under Ancelotti, but it is still a drop-off in quality. So it's never going to get to quite the same height. So just like, obviously, you get maybe a drop-off in the team quality, the player quality isn't quite as high. Even though he had, you know, James Rodriguez, who he'd worked with previously, the quality of player just obviously wasn't the same at Everton, so he wasn't able to get the sort of the star quality.
He's never done more than two seasons at a club since 2009, since taking charge of Chelsea, and he's had a lot of clubs since then. So I guess the obvious question is, does he have a shelf life?
Yeah, I think he does, actually. And I think when you watch his sides week in, week out, you become a little bit more sceptical about his managerial ability compared to just looking at it season by season and seeing that he's won lots of league titles. I think people do become a little bit frustrated with him. I think it's worth pointing out that on a couple of occasions he has resigned to take another job. Certainly was the case with leaving Everton for Real Madrid. And I'm fairly sure the first time around as well, when he went from PSG to Real Madrid. So sometimes it's been by his own making that he's moved on. But yeah, he hasn't really created a dynasty. I don't even know if at Milan you can call it a dynasty, because it was, you know, it was just the same team from beginning to an end, from beginning to the end. And the next managers who came in were the ones who needed to kind of move things forward. You know, I don't think there's been that much legacy of what he did at Milan. So yeah, he is a funny manager, but he certainly gets results and he gets on with players. I mean, we shouldn't underestimate that. There's so many managers that are very good tactically, but find that the players just don't buy into their methods. You know, we've seen that at Manchester United at the moment, just players who don't seem to get on with the manager at all. Ancelotti, aside from that time at Bayern, has rarely had that. And I think that is a really important quality and probably speaks to the fact that he was a great player himself and probably knows how to cope with big players.
That's true, actually. When you think about the respect that the players give him, you know, he's obviously got that experience from his playing days. But I think sort of on the shelf life question, I do think it's largely indicative of the clubs that he has managed as well, which sort of feed into that. So obviously Chelsea, you know, brutal under Abramovich in terms of changing managers all the time. Real Madrid are even more so, you might say, in recent years especially. And to a certain extent, Bayern Munich. I looked into how many managers they've had since 2011. They've had seven managers since 2011. So they're not exactly known for their loyalty, you might say. But a lot of these top clubs like that maybe get their money's worth, make sure they get the title wrapped up and then move the managers on.
There is a place for what he's done though, right? At the very biggest clubs, you know, working with players who are at their peak, established star men and doing what's needed with them for a season generally at most. Of course, the criticisms follow after that, but there is a place for that at these massive clubs, isn't there, Michael? And it seems like he doesn't leave behind a ton of wreckage.
No, I agree with that. I think that is a very good point. It's not like a Mourinho thing where the dressing room's in tatters. That is a good point. This is a slightly new situation in football, I think, where you've got sides who are just dominant in their league. They're almost certainly going to win the league. And maybe they just want managers who are going to come in and just keep things steady. I think that's particularly true at Real Madrid, where you look historically last 20, 30 years, probably going back longer, the manager's never been the star at Real Madrid. It's just not that kind of club. At Barcelona, sometimes the manager's the star. Guardiola was the star. Johan Cruyff was the star. But at Real Madrid, it's almost like the president is the main man. The president's in charge of signing players. Sometimes the president seems to be in charge of saying what players he wants to be on the pitch. The manager's kind of just a kind of middleman in a bizarre way. And Ancelotti, I think, is perfect for that role. I don't think he's necessarily the manager who... kind of manager as well who really fires up the fans, if that makes sense. I mean, I remember when Liverpool got rid of Brendan Rodgers and they were looking for a manager, and the two favourites were either Klopp and Ancelotti. And I know this is very easy to say now, but I really thought at the time, I just can't imagine Ancelotti going in and Liverpool fans saying he just gets it. You know, he just gets the club. He's almost like a kind of slightly standoffish businessman, I would say. Whereas Klopp, obviously what he did at Dortmund was so obviously transferable to Liverpool. And of course, he's become, I think, an even better, by far a better manager than he was at Dortmund at Liverpool. But one of the first things he did was he got the fans on board. And I think that has sustained a lot of what has followed in the last, what is it now, coming up to 7 years. I just can't really see Ancelotti has ever had that same connection with fans.
Mm. Well, he does have a record that will be very difficult to match. 5 league titles in each of Europe's big 5 leagues. One last tough question for you, Michael. It's 5 league titles total for Ancelotti in 16 full seasons. This is not including half seasons or seasons where he left early. 16 full seasons of managing Juventus, Milan, Chelsea, PSG, Real Madrid and Bayern. 5 league titles in 16 full seasons. Less than 1 in 3. Is that a good ratio, acceptable, or a little low?
Maybe it's being half, but I reckon he should have had about 7 by now. I think he should have won one more at Milan, and I think one more either in his second season at Chelsea or maybe that first half season at PSG. So yeah, there's an argument that he's never won more than he should have in terms of league titles. It's such a funny thing to say, because he's done something really remarkable that no one else has. And yet when you look through them one by one, you look at the 5 and you think, well, yeah, expected you to win that. It is a very funny career he's had.
Well, it's also the whole point of this podcast is to ask the difficult questions. It is interesting, as you say, and I think it's worth doing. However, the great tactical historians will remember him. This is a man who's had the sort of career generally only seen on Football Manager, on computer games. Certainly someone you would want to have a long, long dinner with to talk about his career, and has managed a huge proportion of the best players on the planet over the last 20 years. So we didn't want to let this episode go by without putting together an Ancelotti all-time 11. It's pretty tough to do, but you've both had a go at it. Michael, why don't you start? I guess we're playing a 4-3-3 of sorts. Why don't you start with the Ancelotti all-time 11, goalkeeper and back four?
Yeah, funny one with the goalkeeper. We're talking Dida, Petr Cech, Salvatore Sirigu, Manuel Neuer and Thibaut Courtois. I don't think Cech at that point was the Cech we'd seen in previous years. I think Dida was a good goalkeeper. I think it's probably between Neuer and Courtois. And I think Courtois actually had a really good season this time around. So I am going to go for Thibaut Courtois as my Ancelotti goalkeeper.
What about you, Mark?
I've probably gone a little bit more for his historical sort of importance in the Premier League. I have gone for Petr Cech in goal. But I do take what Michael said in terms of that season while Ancelotti was there. Maybe a slightly different story, but I've been skewed by my perception of history.
Okay, let's look at Ancelotti fullbacks. Some of them had more work to do going forward than others, of course, at times. The right backs, Cafu, Branislav Ivanovic, Jale, Lahm and Carvajal, and the left backs, Pancaro, Cole, Maxwell, Alaba and Mendy. Michael.
Well, right back, I mean, I think this has often been his weakest position. It can't be Ivanovic for that season. Jale, definitely not. And Danny Carvajal's really struggling this season. So it's between Lahm and Cafu. I just about go for Cafu. I mean, they're both brilliant. They're both all-time great right-backs. But I think in terms of just what you want from an Ancelotti system, which is width and overlapping, I think you have to go for Cafu. On the other side, I would go for David Alaba. I think Ashley Cole's probably the main contender. But again, I don't think Ashley Cole was quite as best in that league-winning campaign. So Alaba for me.
I definitely agree with everything you said there, Michael. I have gone for Cafu at right back. Again, maybe it's my perception, my Premier League skew, but I have gone for Ashley Cole at left back. I was thinking of being a bit too smart and putting Maldini at left back, but we'll come on to my centre backs from there.
Well, it's a hell of a list of centre backs, I tell you that, starting with Nesta and Maldini and then heading to Carvalho and Terry, Thiago Silva and Mamadou Sakho, Martinez and Hummels at Bayern, and this season Militao and David Alaba. Could have a situation where we have Alaba in Michael's team twice, but I suspect probably not.
Yeah, if you're being really clever, you could have Alex twice, the Brazilian centre back who played at both Chelsea and PSG, but I don't think many people would choose that. I'm actually going to stick with Milan. Nesta and Maldini, just a great partnership. John Terry comes into the equation, I think, or comes into the conversation. Thiago Silva, obviously an all-time great, but he was injured quite a lot that season that they won the league title under Ancelotti. So, yeah, I've got three Milan defenders, Cafu, Nesta and Maldini.
Yeah, Nesta and Maldini. You can't really look beyond them. I mean, I was equally going to maybe think of adding John Terry to the list, but Nesta and Maldini, and they sort of come as a partnership as well, so you can't have Nesta without Maldini and vice versa. So, yeah, got to agree.
I'm quite pleased that I don't have to pick three of this batch of central midfield players. Pirlo, Gattuso and Seedorf at AC Milan, Mikel, Ballack and Lampard at Chelsea, Motta, Verratti, Matuidi. At Bayern, Xavi Alonso, Arturo Vidal and Thiago, and at Real Madrid, Casemiro, Modric and Kroos. He was a midfield player himself, wasn't he, Michael? And I always think, as I said earlier, of central midfield players when I think of Ancelotti. This is a hell of a gang.
Yeah, this is quite tough to choose between. I mean, this is just the size that he's won the title with. I mean, you could go back and get Juventus and Parma, and you've got, I mean, across the pitch, you've got likes of Cannavaro and Thuram and Buffon and Zidane and Zaghi. I mean, it's absolute, it must have the best composite 11 ever. I'm going to go for Andrea Pirlo in the holding role. I think he's just completely era-defining player, and I think he was a better player than Xabi Alonso in that role. And as my two more advanced midfielders, I'm going to go for the current two of Modric and Kroos, who I think have a great partnership and work really well together.
Mine's very similar again. I've got Pirlo holding, I've got Modric ahead, and I've got to include Frank Lampard as well. Especially that season, highest goal scoring season of his career when he was with Ancelotti. So Pirlo, Lampard and Modric for me.
And in the front three, we got a real mixture, of course, because you know, he did flip a little from Diamond and Christmas Tree to more standard 4-3-3. So we've got a mixture of wide men and attacking midfielders here. Rui Costa and Kaká at AC Milan, Malouda and Anelka, El Flaco Pastore and Lavezzi at PSG, Thomas Müller and Arjen Robben at Bayern, and this season Asensio and Vinicius. Michael, who are your two behind or to the side of a striker?
You know what? If you allow me, I'm going to go for Diamond. I'm going to have one number 10 and two strikers because Ancelotti has played that way a fair amount. Rui Costa is my favourite ever player, but I can't have him ahead of Kaká that season for Milan. Kaká was the best. And it's so tough to choose two strikers. It's two of Shevchenko, Drogba, Ibrahimovic, Lewandowski and Benzema. I really don't know. I'm going to go for Benzema because I think at the moment he's close to the best player in the world. And I'm just about going to go for Ibrahimovic, not necessarily because he was the best player, but because I think of how dominant, how crucial he was to PSG that title-winning season. It really was all about him. So, yeah, Ibrahimovic and Benzema for me.
Mine's a bit lopsided. It's just mainly to fit in who I wanted. So I've gone for Arjen Robben and Kaká behind Lewandowski. But Kaká would obviously be playing far more narrow. Robben would be hugging the touchline, coming inside, putting the balls in for Lewandowski. So there's a bit of method to it, I suppose, but it might be a little bit lopsided.
I quite like that. I like that balance. And I love Arjen Robben as well, so I do appreciate that.
Enjoyed this exercise. I'm going to tweet out the list of players to choose from Ancelotti's five title wins. And please put together your own Ancelotti composite 11 on Twitter at AliMaxwell_. It'd be great to see how you guys approach this. And I've really enjoyed chatting through this remarkable, hugely successful career of Carlo Ancelotti, which has a lot more to discuss within it than just celebrating five titles. So thank you to Michael, thank you to Mark for chatting me through it. You can read all of their writing on the Athletic site, so much more as well, of course. If you head to theathletic.com/tactics, you can get your annual subscription today, and you'll pay just £1 a month for the first six. Hell of a deal. Head to theathletic.com/tactics and subscribe today. Make sure you're signed up to this podcast on whichever podcast platform you use. You'll get every episode landing fresh as soon as it's released. And join us again next week. Thanks for listening to the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast.
The Athletic.